Today's episode of Socially Democratic is presented to you by Dunn Street. Dunn Street is a campaign agency that specialises in community organising. We work with people that want to build power to make the world a better place, including community-based organisations, trade unions, progressive businesses and social democratic parties across the globe. We develop community engagement strategies to win campaigns both big and small. We train engagement staff and volunteers in the GANTS framework of leadership, organising and action. And we help folks craft their story through the practice of public narrative that connects people through shared values and moves them to act together. And if you want to get folks to act together in 2024, then hit us up at dunstreet.com.au. Today's episode is also brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. As Australia's number one plaintiff law firm, Maurice Blackburn believed the law should serve everyone, not just those who can afford it. And Maurice Blackburn have helped influence some of Australia's most important legal decisions, including equal pay for women and Indigenous workers, and helped over 500,000 Australians get the compensation they deserve. I almost undercut how many people they've helped. Maurice Blackburn Lawyers, experience you can count on. Hello and welcome to another episode of Socially Democratic, your weekly centre-left politics and organising podcast that drops every Friday, that dives into the progressive campaigns of the day and the people leading them from home and abroad. We're kind of going abroad again today. We're going across the Tasman. No, across the Bass Strait. Jeez, Stephen, get the geography right. We're going to Tasmania for our third and final installment of coverage of the Tasmanian elections, which took place on Saturday. Unfortunately, it wasn't the result that we were expecting for the Labor Party, but political consultant and friend of the pod, Jack Milroy, will be on the show today just to unpack Saturday's results. The count is actually still going, but we kind of have a fairly good idea about how it's going to land. This episode is coming out Friday, but there will be new results. We're recording this on a Wednesday, but new results are coming out tomorrow on Thursday, which you most likely will know by the time you listen to the show. Having said that, we've done more than just talk about the results. We're talking about what this election outcome means for all the different parties, in particular the Labor Party. So looking forward to chatting to Jack about that today. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And when you're done listening to the show, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and leave us a review. And for all the updates, follow Dunn Street on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Okay. Oh, actually, before I say let's get today's episode, next week's episode is our Feeney Files, our monthly Feeney Files episode with former campaign director, Labor campaign director and MP, Senator David Feeney. I think he calls it the Feeney Hour of Power. We're still in debate about what we are going to name this show, but it's our monthly recap of what has happened in politics in Australia. If you've got any questions of David or any topics that you want us to talk about, on our socials, just send us a message, either on, even to me on Twitter or on LinkedIn or whatever, just the Dunn Street platforms that I just mentioned before. Just send us a message and Rebecca, our producer, will sort them out and then flick them to me and we'll talk about them in the show next week. We're recording that one next Wednesday, so just after Easter, and that will be up next Friday. Okay, let's get to today's episode. We are taping this one on a Wednesday afternoon on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. And I know that I start every single episode with telling you when we're taping it. And you're probably wondering, Stephen, why do you keep on telling us what day you're taping it? And to be honest, I don't know the answer to that too. I think I did it in the very first episode many, many moons ago, and now I just can't stop doing it. And I'm just sticking with it because I don't know how to start the show. But sometimes it is useful to know when we're taping it, particularly when we're doing an episode that is covering the election results immediately after the election. And we're doing the Tasmanian election today, as you know. And it is ever evolving. So it is important to note that we are taping this one on a Wednesday, but there are more results due to come out on Thursday, the 28th of March. So some of the things that we're going to be talking about in today's episode will be a little bit out of date by the time you listen to this on Friday when the election drops. And probably saying, Stephen, well, then why didn't you record it on Thursday? Unfortunately,
calendars mean that I just can't do the episode tomorrow, unfortunately, and we wanted to get something out this week. But that's okay because we're going to be talking to an expert that knows Tasmanian politics, so all of his analysis and predictions will be 100% correct. And that is Jack Milroy. So setting the bar high for you, Jack Milroy. Welcome back for our final episode of this Tasmanian election.
I'm happy to be here for the trilogy, the return of the Jedi of the socially democratic Tasmanian election coverage.
Nice pop culture reference. Always love a good pop culture reference. Return of the Jedi is I was about to say, where does it sit in the pantheon of all of the episodes? It's definitely top five, isn't it?
It's definitely top five, but in the original trilogy, they definitely peaked at the second one. So let's hope that didn't happen to us too.
No. Well, you know, Empire Strikes Back. I think in some ways the Empire has continued to run the show in Tasmania by the results on the weekend. So let's talk about that. Yeah. But actually, before we do that, maybe you can give folks out in podcast land an update on what is the counting process at this time with this post-Saturday election count.
Yeah. Look, they've counted about 85%, I think, overall of the vote, of the first preference vote, and including counting preferences now as well. Like, I think we're at the point now where there's one big kind of dump of ballots. That sounds bad, but there's a round of results to be announced tomorrow on Thursday.
If this was a Trump episode, people would be freaking out. There's going to be a dump of ballots.
A dump of ballots. Yeah, we're just waiting on the Allegheny County ballots right now before we can make a call. So we'll get some more results. Stop the steal. Yeah, that's right. So we'll get a little bit more tomorrow, but we're at the point where we, you know, kind of know, I would say, roughly to 95% certainty what the makeup of the next parliament will be. There are some intra-party fights left where it's like, where is it going to be, this liberal or that liberal in a particular seat? So, you know, I guess that's interesting for folks, but it doesn't really affect the overall numbers. And there's really only one or two seats that are actually in doubt as to which party will control them. So we're almost finished. They count them pretty quickly and distribute preferences pretty quickly, which is, you know, pretty amazing when some folks are voting 35, you know, numbers on their ballot, or 31 if you live in Franklin and you put Eric Abetz last, which, you know, I'm sure everyone did. So you know, they do a good job. But yeah, we won't know for certain, for sure, for full results probably until after Easter.
Okay, interesting. That's good. Good context setting. Then let's. What I want to do first is I want to do an overview of the results. Then I want to go seat by seat because there are only five seats, and just get your sort of reflections on what is left, what is still in play, or what is the likely outcome. Therefore, we can then start to kind of get a sense of what the final results will be, and then we can start to unpack the results in a more detailed sense, party by party, and some of the moving feasts that are happening, starting with the overall results. So what is the overall – there's 18 seats to win to form government. What is the overall state of play for parties at this point in time in terms of seats won?
Yeah, at this point in time, if you look at the seats that have been, you know, officially called by the ABC, you've got 13 seats for the Liberals, 10 seats for Labor, 4 seats for the Greens, 2 seats for the Independents, and 2 seats for the Lambie Network. So I'm going to get the math wrong, but there's a couple of seats left that they haven't officially called. Now, if you then look at really good election observers, you're looking at Kevin Bonham and Ben Round and Tally Room and stuff like that. Basically, they're saying that to a pretty high degree of certainty, the parliament will look like 15 Liberals, 10 Labor, 5 Greens, 3 Lambie Network, and 2 Independents. So that adds up to 35. So the Liberals will have 15, and they'll need another 3 for a majority in the House. At the moment, they're talking with the Lambie Network, who are predicted to have 3, to get them to 18.
Right, okay. And interesting. So I guess the question – actually, before I do that, before I deep dive into that one, let's go through the seats, and I want to start with Bass.
Just give us an And maybe we should start the top line too. Sorry to interrupt you, Stephen, but
you're right.
the primaries too, and how maybe they compared to the last election, because please there was do. there was a significant. So the kind of overall story out of this election is a significant decline in the Liberal Party vote, a swing of about 12% against them. So they went from close to 50 to, you know 30, 37, 38, something like that. Labor, relatively flat, maybe a 1% swing towards us. The Greens, also relatively flat, maybe only a 1% swing towards them. The overall independent vote's up 3, and the Lambie vote, Lambie didn't run last time, is up 6.7 right now. So basically what's happened is the Liberals have lost a big chunk of their vote, but Labor hasn't been able to capture that. And interestingly, the Greens didn't also capture it, but their vote was more efficiently distributed this time, which is why they've resulted in seat gains. Lambie's network has captured a big chunk of that disaffected Liberal vote. So that's kind of the overall kind of picture of what happened.
Which, to your credit, is essentially what we talked about and mused last week in our preview episode. We kind of, from published polling, it looked like the Labor vote was just not moving, and that there was a drop off in the primary vote for the Liberal Party, and where it was going to go was a question that kind of we were arming and arguing about. Does it go to the Greens? That's does it right. go to other? Does it go to Jackie Lambie? But it looks like they've benefited the most.
That's right, and remembering that with the expansion of Parliament, even if you hold your own on your kind of vote count, you should be expected to pick up couple of seats because there's more seats available. That Labor may have picked up one on what we had last time, but the Greens have been able to pick up, I think, up to 3. So they've done really well. And obviously Lambie's looking like they might pick up 3 as well. So that's where the additional seats have really gone.
Okay, interesting. So let's take a look at the seats and run through them alphabetically, starting with Bass. Just your reflections on what the outcome, the results were in the electorate of Bass.
Yeah, so in Bass, the Liberals suffered a big swing against them. Largely put that down to the fact that Peter Gutwin, who was the former Premier and was a candidate at the last election, received a massive personal vote, I think he got close to 3 quotas or something himself. So the Liberals have suffered a swing against them in Bass. The Liberals suffered a swing against them everywhere, but in the north it was more pronounced. And you can put that down to a number of factors, one of them being the unpopularity of the proposed stadium in Hobart in the north. You can also just put that down to when your vote is really, really, really high, you're more likely through reversion to the mean to lose more in that area. So in Bass, they lost a chunk of vote. And it looks like right now the Liberals will get 3 out of Bass. It's still kind of in doubt who will fully, take all those Liberal spots. Labor has re-elected our 2 members in Bass, Michelle O'Byrne and Janie Finley. And the Liberals, the Greens have picked up a seat in Bass where they didn't have one before. And also Lambie's picked up a seat in Bass as well.
So remembering, folks, that this election, each of these seats are expanding in the amount of seats to members to be elected to be sent to the House of Assembly. And so just in this first observation here, Jack, have the Lambie or the minor parties benefited more from this expansion of seats than the major parties? I mean, obviously is that true? I mean, like obviously we've got our 2 folks re-elected, but we didn't pick up a third.
We didn't pick up a third, and the Liberals have picked up 3, and I believe they only got 3 last time. So yes, overall, where we've expanded in each seat, the Parliament has expanded in each seat, the number of seats available. The Greens have done really, really well, and the Lambie Network has done well. Mm-hmm. Something that wasn't particularly well predicted before Election Day was the independent vote. The independent vote's actually lower than folks predicted. Labor vote's a little bit higher than what some of the polling predicted, so some of that's gone to us. But the Lambie vote and the Green vote, Lambie vote's up significantly and the Green vote's up a little bit too. So the kind of community independence, tealish type political movement that's obviously been really successful in Melbourne and in Sydney has not taken off here. Lambie has kind of eaten up what you might traditionally think as that section of the vote. So that's something that's been interesting coming out of this, but also not surprising given Jackie Lambie's kind of popularity in Tasmania.
Fair play. Okay, let's go to Braddon.
Mm-hmm. Cedar Braddon, let me just pull it up here. So in Braddon, the results that we have, one sec.
I can help you out there while you're finding it. The re-elected, the Liberal Party had two re-elections. They had, testing my eyesight here, Jeremy Rutcliffe and is it Felix Ellis?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I've got that here now. So so the Liberals have re-elected Rutcliffe and Ellis, and they'll get a third as well. And it'll either be Yanch, who's an incumbent, or Giovanna Simpson, who I believe is the deputy mayor of Burnie and is a Liberal. Labor will re-elect Shane Broad and Anita Dow, who are our incumbents from Bass. And then there is a bit of a battle between two of the Jackie Lambie candidates. It's uncertain which of those will get up. And there is a complicated in the count battle between a fourth Liberal and an independent called Craig Garland, who's kind of been a perennial candidate up there, kind of anti-salmon farming, anti-forestry campaigner. So again, Labor's not been able to add any additional seats in Braddon. Demographically, that's an extremely hard seat for a modern Labor Party. It's older, it's whiter, and it is lower income. Those are not things that necessarily work well for the Labor Party in 2024. So not unexpected, but certainly I think the days of Labor kind of dominating in Braddon and the Northwest are probably behind us.
So there are four currently being re-elected, two Labor, two Liberal. Is there two more spots available to in that seat?
So currently the way that observers have it called is three Liberal, two Labor, and one Lambie Network, so that gets us to six.
Yep.
And then there's a battle for seventh between an additional Liberal and the independent.
Or potentially an independent. Okay, interesting. Rightio. Let's go to Clark.
Mm-hmm. Clark. So in Clark, Labor has been able to add an extra member, which is great. Josh Willey, who was a popular member in the upper house in the northern suburbs of Hobart, was able to come down to the lower house effectively. And we also re-elected Ella Haddad, who is a Labor incumbent in Clark. Other than that, you've got two Labor, two Liberals, a Green, and Christy Johnson, who is an independent. And then that obviously leaves us, that takes us to six. And then there's kind of a fight over the last seat between, a three-way fight, if you like, between an additional Green, a Labor Party candidate, one of two, and Sue Hickey, who's an independent. As of where the count stands right now, observers are kind of saying, look, that's probably pretty safe for the Greens for them to pick up an extra seat there. It looks unlikely, but, you know, we'll see what happens with the next batch of votes, but it looks likely that we'll have two Labor, two Liberals, two Greens, and one independent in Clark.
Interesting. Okay. Franklin.
The seat of Franklin bucks the trend a little bit on that kind of lower independent vote that I spoke about, because former Labor leader David O'Byrne ran as an independent and has been re-elected and with quite a high vote. So what that's looking for right now is kind of three Liberals, two for the ALP. That would be Dean Winter and probably Meg Brown, but there's an internal contest between Meg Brown and Toby Thorpe for the Labor Party for that second Labor seat, one independent, David O'Byrne, and one Green, and that takes us to seven. The downside of Franklin, of course, is that it looks likely to return Erica Betts to the state parliament when we all thought Erica Betts was done in our lives.
Remind me, what was Eric doing before he ran as a candidate for the Liberal Party in this state election?
Yeah, in between being a senator and now, he said he had a consulting business. So I believe he was associated with some sort of it was either the No campaign in The Voice or maybe a monarchist thing or something. I don't know. Some sort of like conservative movement campaign and apparently some consulting. So I'm not sure.
Right. I just don't understand. I mean, I don't know how old Eric Abetz is, but you'd think after a reasonably distinguished, whether you agree with his politics or not, but a distinguished career as a Tasmanian senator, that you would just hang the boots up and go and enjoy retirement.
I mean, certainly that's what I would do, but he doesn't seem to want to do that. He was, it was interesting. He was on the ABC's election night panel for the Liberals, which I thought was an interesting choice by the Liberal Party. And he wasn't particularly charitable or effusive towards his leader, Jeremy Rockliffe, on that panel. And obviously there's a lot of speculation that Eric is interested in leadership himself. So we'll kind of watch this space and see what happens. But I can't imagine that would be particularly popular with the Tasmanian electorate at large. The Tassie Liberals have been successful largely because they've been able to position as quite moderate over the last 10 years, starting with Will Hodgman. And a similar strategy to that, which the New South Wales Liberals pursued under Gladys Berejiklian, which was to basically grab a Labor policy anytime they had one and just implement it. So they don't quite have the reputation for competence that the New South Wales Liberals had, even if you disagreed with their politics. But I think Erica Betts as leader would probably be a bridge too far for Tasmania.
A good friend of mine texted me during the week who listens to the show, says that the current Tasmanian government is one of one of Australia's greatest Labor governments, sarcastically talking about obviously their run.
It is quite, and we saw this in the campaign. I think we talked about this last time, this like neutralization of policy where Labor would come out with a policy and the Liberals would just be like, yeah, sure, we'll do that. Yeah, fine. And it really did in a lot of ways cut Labor's legs out from underneath us in that campaign. Obviously, you know, fair game. That's an election. That's their strategy. We need to find a way to combat that. But, you know, I think it was successful, clearly, given that they'll be returned in minority.
Yeah. Okay. And then the last seat is the seat of Lions.
Yeah, seat of Lions. So, obviously, this is the east coast of Tasmania. It's a massive seat. Takes up, I think, more than 50% of the geography of Tasmania. So what we're looking at there right now, we've got three Liberals. To Labor, obviously that's Rebecca White, who had a huge vote, a quarter and a half or something like that, I believe, for herself. And then on the tails of that, re-elected Jen Butler, who's an incumbent. One Green, and then there is a fight in the for the last seat, I believe, between the Lambie network and Labor. So Labor's in for a shot to pick up an extra one there, which would put us at 11 overall. However, kind of election analysts are saying that the Lambie network has the upper hand in that count at the moment.
Okay, so we've got this analysis. Folks have got a bit of a sense of where the parties performed across the five seats. There's obviously, you said at the top of the program, there's negotiations going on right now between the Liberal Party and Jackie Lambie. What is your feeling in terms of their likelihood of finding consensus to form some kind of coalition?
Well, the signals from Lambie since the election have been mostly positive towards that, which is interesting because if you observe the campaign, Jackie Lambie was extremely critical of the Liberals, not necessarily on policy terms, but the Liberals had a jackielambie.com.au or .com website that essentially faked her website, standard campaign practice, but Jackie Lambie got quite upset about it. Yep. And that website was taken down pretty promptly after election night, as you can imagine. And I also saw reporting that URL was handed back, the domain was handed back over to, handed to the Lambie network, gifted to them, which, you know, I suppose makes sense if you're trying to negotiate a minority government deal. Reporting says that the Greens leader, Rosalie Woodruff, who now has five MPs, which is half the number that Labor has not been contacted by any of the party leaders since election night. So it seems like the Liberal strategy is to do a deal with Lambie for those three seats. They'll still need to provide a speaker too, which will be interesting, whether they try to provide a speaker from their own ranks or try to poach one from somewhere else in the parliament. But certainly it seems that all of the indications at this point coming from Lambie are that, you know, this will work. For how long, who knows? But it seems to be that they're going to be able to cobble together a minority.
Because the challenge is also with a lot of these new and emerging minor parties that exist for, you know, a decade and then kind of fall apart, is that their candidate selection can often be scratchy.
That's right.
And the, you know, for a mainstream political party like the Liberal Party or the Labor Party, having to work with these crossbenchers in any kind of setting, whether it be a Hare Clark election or a traditional PPR, those kind of conversations, you might get the deal, but then when you start, when the rubber hits the road, you can find that they can be a little bit freaky deaky in some of the things that they agree on. Yeah. You can see it start to unpack, right? Like, you don't actually know who are these people, these characters that have been elected by the Lambie network. I mean,
we don't know. I mean, I don't think even any of them are elected to council here. I mean, they're kind of, you know, you might describe them as political randos. You know, maybe all of their own accord, or, you know, have good life experience and may make great MPs. Who knows? We have seen examples in this country of, you know, folks who have been elected under one banner and have gone on to become independents or switch parties. So
Jackie Lambie, for example.
Jackie Lambie, right? Yeah, elected under the Palmer United, Palmer Network, or what it was called at the time. So I think the challenge here that they're going to have is that the agreement is for confidence and supply, but the agreement is not to vote for government legislation. So, okay. The problem will be that the Lambie Network didn't have a policy platform going into this election. And the Liberals were quite good at making hay out of that, finding some statements of Lambie Network candidates in the past who had supported the stadium, some who'd opposed it. Lambie herself opposes it. The government has said that it's, you know, a precondition for kind of everything they do. So I think what's going to be really interesting is probably less the confidence in supply. I reckon that will probably hold for a little while at least. Mm. But whether the government is actually able to move its legislative agenda forward will be really, really interesting.
The independents, remind me again, how many independents are we thinking that would likely end up in the
two?
Stay
at two, yeah. So Christy Johnson, who was already elected in Clark, and David O'Byrne, former Labor leader. So both experienced, well-known in their electorates. I wouldn't expect anything too wild to come out of there.
Okay, so the independent in Clark, Christy Johnson, you would imagine that she obviously is centre-right leaning as well, so that would be...
No, center left leading, I would say.
Oh, really?
Some independence is a bit hard to pigeonhole. It depends on the issue, but certainly on a range of issues around integrity, climate, you know, transport, stuff like that. She's the liberal criticism of Christie is that she has drifted to the left since she was elected as an independent.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so the two, and obviously David O'Byrne's politics is Labor.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, so not a lot of help from those guys then. So the question before about Speaker is a challenge then, right? Where do they, what do they do there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they can try to pull one from their own ranks and have a casting vote, have the Speaker conduct a casting vote anytime there is a tie, which is actually what the Liberal Party has done for at least the last 6 years. So they have been in minority for quite a long time. Based on defections, and even before the 2021 election, when Sue Hickey left the Liberal Party to sit as an independent as Speaker, was casting a casting vote as well. So my guess is that they won't appoint, you know, or ask an independent to become the Speaker, although I could be wrong. My guess is that they will try to appoint a Speaker from within their ranks and just use the casting vote.
Okay, let's talk about the elephant in the room. And because we've discussed the pathway to government, minority government for the Liberal Party, but then let's talk about it for the Labor Party. And I don't think we can talk about it unless we talk about the decisions that have been made by the Administrative Committee of the Tasmanian branch of the Australian Labor Party over the weekend. Can you give us the backstory here, first of all, for those that aren't aware of this?
And the first thing I'll say too is that, I mean, the Administrative Committee is what has been reported as making these decisions, so you'll be forgiven for thinking that, but it is actually the Special Branch Committee, which was appointed by the National Executive when the intervention took place. The Tasmanian branch is still under intervention. The administrators were released from their duties, Nick and Doug, but the branch is still under intervention from the National Secretariat. So that's just kind of the first just point of clarification, and that's a group of six folks that were appointed back a year and a half ago, whenever that happened.
Yep.
So what happened on the weekend was that on election night, the Premier came out first, which is quite unusual, claimed victory, even though it was less than clear at that point whether he wouldn't have a majority, and was less than clear whether he could cobble a minority. Labor leader Rebecca White came out next, gave a speech that was really well received in the tally room and by party members, talking about, you know, minority governments might be a new normal in Tasmania, which is just factually true in a PR system like ours, and that, you know, you work with the parliament you've got. And then the next morning, it was reported that Labor, the Special Branch Committee, had decided that Labor would not be entering into negotiations to form a minority government. Therefore, they declared that the election had not been won by Labor. And under Labor's rules, whenever Labor loses a state election, the leadership position is spilled. So there was some, on Sunday, there was some confusion on Twitter and stuff around what had actually happened. But really what had happened is that, you know, the party had formed the view, which, you know, Rebecca supports, that it was not possible for Labor to form a minority government based on 10 seats. It was too hard to get to 18. Mm-hmm. It would not be seen as politically legitimate, and especially given that the Liberals get the first chance to meet the Parliament, the Premier gets to meet the Parliament to try to form a minority, you know, the chances that Labor after that would then, that would fail, that Labor would then cobble together minority and then we would kind of govern in some way. Understanding that that is legitimate under our Westminster system, of course, but probably not politically realistic.
And obviously on Twitter and social media in general, amongst our base, people were kind of up in arms on Monday, Tuesday, saying, why are they doing this? Why are they moved so quickly when there was still an opportunity? Yeah. Which, you know, I can see the optimist in our comrades about, you know, there's still a chance, like Homer with the pig flying in the air. It's still good. But I guess the hard heads within the party have sort of said, no, this isn't going to happen. So we just need to go through what we're obliged to do based on the rules.
That's right. And look, you know, the party has people who know how these counts go. They're expert at this stuff. And if they're looking at the numbers and thinking we're going to end on 10, we're not going to end on 12 or whatever it may be, you know, there's a reason that they think that. Of course, this parliament may not go 4 years. It may not go 3 years. We don't know what will happen. And Labor had ruled out any deals for government with the Greens or with minor parties, as late as election night. So they were in a bit of a bind when they, you know, ruled out deals. And of course, you know, can you make a minority government without deals? I guess what's your definition of deals? But, yeah. You know, Labor had taken a pretty clear position to the electorate.
Okay. What I want to do now is I actually just want to run through all the parties and get a sense from you about what were you think were, like if we could do a short post-election debrief or analysis or recap or reflection on each of the campaigns.
Autopsy.
Yeah, autopsy, exactly. If we were the folks that were asked to come in and do the campaign review, let's go through all the parties. But in my list I had the Liberal Party first, but actually let's just keep talking about the Labor Party while we're here, because that's obviously, this is a Labor Party podcast. So Labor Party, upsides from the campaign for you?
Upsides from the campaign were that it was a disciplined campaign, run in a fairly professional way, an improvement on the 2021 campaign, party unity and discipline. So some upsides there for sure in terms of the kind of, you know, implementation of the campaign. Labor has brought Josh Willey down from the upper house into the lower house. So that's an addition of talent. It looks like we'll get Meg Brown in Franklin, who's, a younger candidate as well, which is great. So there is some refresh in the ranks, which is fantastic. So that'd be the upsides, I would say.
Then I guess the deltas or the challenges or the downsides that we see from the campaign, or maybe if you want to frame it in a key learning, what lessons do we want to take from this particular campaign?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the challenge Labor had in that campaign was that when you're going to the electorate, essentially, you know, for the third time in a row, with kind of the same leader and leadership team, as well as that leadership team and the leader performed, clearly there just wasn't appetite for that in the electorate. And I think, you know, and Becca's taken responsibility and acknowledged that, and you know, the party will go through a process now. But I think that was hard to overcome. I also think that the Liberals have a structural fundraising advantage as well in this state, and that's always difficult to overcome until we get public financing introduced, which will come in after the next election. So that's always a challenge for Labor as well.
Did we get outspent by them? And where did we get outspent?
We don't know yet, but we typically do get outspent, something like 3-1. And we get outspent... We hold our own pretty well online with digital and ads. I think where we get outspent is potentially staff and essentially organizing. And then we may also get outspent in forms of traditional media advertising as well, which I'm not as familiar with. I'd say that was a challenge. I would say just one more challenge for Labor out of this, and something that we should learn from, is I think we could make better use of our union affiliates in our campaigns. We could leverage the power of the labor movement more, and I think there's probably some work to do there to rebuild some relationships and trust. And you know, that goes both ways, of course. But I think that's it's a big asset that Labor Party branches leverage everywhere else, and I think that's something we could do here.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that point in a moment. One question I want to ask you before that, though, is you talked about fresh blood into the caucus. I remember when I was a party official for the Victorian branch, I went down to Tasmania to talk to the caucus and also to the then party secretary about some key lessons that we had from Victoria. I can't even remember what it was. Maybe it was after 2014. And I remember going in and meeting the caucus. And in my brain, right, when you go meet a caucus of a Labor Party, there's normally a lot of people in the room. Like you think about the Labor caucus here in Victoria, like it's, you know, 70 odd or however many people, right? It's a big room. Mm-hmm. And I walked in and I got there a little bit early and it was quite a small room. I was thinking, where's everyone going to fit? But everyone fit quite easily around this table because there was only, you know, however many there were, 10, 12 or something like that.
Yeah.
In such a small parliament, and I know that the population of Tasmania is only around 500,000 of the 500,000 electors. And there's an argument that maybe Tasmania is overrepresented in terms of its politics. But nonetheless, it's still a small chamber, and that means it's a small parliament. That means there's a lot of heavy lifting has to be done by, you know, at this point it's looking like 10, maybe 11 members of parliament. And you've just increased the size of the parliament. Structurally, does that present a challenge?
It does.
From
it
resourcing, does right? And ideas and creativity and bringing in new folks and...
Absolutely. There's a few ways to look at that. And the first is that, you know, all of our members of caucus are also shadow ministers at the moment, you know, and will continue to be. So, and often they'll have 2 to 3 shadow ministries to you know, track and shadow and develop policy around. That's a lot of work. At the same time, the staffing budgets for state MPs in Tasmania are horrendously low. It's something like 1 staff member. And that includes, so there's no additional staff if you're a shadow minister, you know. So like you've got 1 staff member to do your electorate office, you've got 1 staff member to do your constituent stuff, you've got to do policy by yourself, you've got to do, you know, it's very difficult. And along with that comes an underfunded Labor Party office as well. The Labor Party, because we don't have public financing down here and there isn't the fundraising base and our unions are not as big, the party office can't take up a lot of that slack because they just are underfunded. So, you know, there are some real structural issues around resourcing that we need to get on top of for the next election on the party side. And then on the parliamentary side, and this is something, maybe Jackie Lambie, because she's still quite dirty about losing those staff members at the in the federal parliament, maybe she can negotiate a higher staffing allotment for our MPs. So Jackie, if you're listening, that would be fantastic. So yeah, look, it is a challenge. They have a lot on their plates. And then, then they have to compete in a Hare Clark system where they're running their own campaigns effectively against other Labor candidates. So Labor Party office or the central campaign doesn't, you know, kind of play favourites or pick candidates to put resources behind. They don't have lead candidates. So these folks are also out there individually running their own election campaigns without the kind of, you know, full backing that you might get from a party office in a marginal seat on one of the mainland states. So it is very challenging to be opposition here, and I think you have a real structural disadvantage in opposition. I mean, you have that everywhere, but potentially it could be worse and harder.
Just some thoughts or reflections on the leadership of Rebecca White. You know, this is her third election. She's obviously not recontesting the leadership going forward. Just looking back on her career, I'm sure her career isn't over as a member of parliament. But certainly as a leader of the caucus, just want to get your thoughts on her job and her time in that position.
Yeah, I think she's done a good job in a really, really difficult position, taking over the leadership of the party after a long Labor government that was not popular at the end. So I think that was a difficult task. And I think she's managed the party well in that time. She's been a really good performer publicly, worked very hard. And she's not going anywhere, as I understand. She's going to stick around as a member of parliament. And hopefully we see her as a minister in Labor government, you know, sooner rather than later. So I think, you know, anyone who does 3 terms as an opposition leader, like you've got to give respect to that because it's not easy.
Yeah, there's I don't know if there's a place in Labor heaven for those types of people, but certainly there needs to be some sort of knighthood or sainthood that needs to be attributed to folks that have done that, because that's a lot of heavy lifting, particularly in a state like Tasmania, to your point earlier, that is short on resources.
Absolutely. There's not a lot of glory in being a Tasmanian opposition leader. So, you know, like it is tough.
Yeah, absolutely. What happens next for the Labor Party?
Yeah, so the Labor Party, and so Rebecca has announced that she won't be contesting the leadership. So the leadership is spilled after an election loss, and Rebecca could have contested again, of course, as a member of caucus, but she will not be recontesting the leadership. So there will be a call for nominations for potential leadership candidates. That won't occur until well after Easter and the results are finalised, because in theory, if there's a different makeup of caucus than what we expect, that could affect who might nominate. So Essentially, there will be no formal call for nominations for a week or two, and then the party will open nominations. And the expectation is that there will be a contested ballot for leader. The process to elect a leader in Tasmania is a 50-50 process, very similar to the federal Labor leadership. So 50% weighting to rank and file ballot, 50% weighting to a caucus ballot. And so the expectation is there'll be a contested ballot, likely one candidate from each faction will run. And I think it'll be fantastic. I think that, Labor has lost four elections straight now, when you include the one that we lost to lose government under Lara Giddings. So I think, and a lot of people share this view that a robust exchange of ideas around policy, around future direction, conducted respectfully, is probably the best thing for the party at this point in time. It can be healthy, it can engage people, it can bring new people into the process, and we probably need that energy right now. So, I think it can only be a good thing. And we saw in the federal sphere, when Shorten and Albo contested the leadership back, I'm guessing this year after 2013, I guess, was that it was healthy. It was good for the party. It was engaging for the party. You had party members coming together. You had debates. You had events. It was actually really, really good. And I think that could apply here in Tasmania as well.
I 100% agree. I think this was a byproduct of Kevin Rudd's leadership coming out of the 2013 period, between that sort of Rudd-Gillard-Rudd era of Labor federal governments. And I think you could do a whole podcast series on the pros and cons of that government. But one of the, I think, the pros that came out of it was introducing this kind of rank and file balance with caucus election for leader. And to your point, yeah, it was a really, really... Even though losing government in 2013 was disheartening, I think there was a rejuvenation and a refocus of energy coming out of that open democratic process of bringing in our rank and file membership into the conversation, and obviously using their electoral power as well to vote. And I thought it was a really, really good thing. The only downside is that anyone who was involved in the actual campaign to then go and actually work on one of the two candidates' campaigns, they're all exhausted. I remember talking, I was a party official at the time, but I remember talking to folks that had been working their butts off at a local level in a local race, and then had to step up and support either Albo's campaign or Bill's. You could see in their eyes they were fatigued. So I don't know how we fix that, but broadly speaking, I think it's a really, really positive thing for the party and for our democracy as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the timing helps, given that the ballots will take quite a while to count. We've got Easter in between. People will get some time off, but I totally agree. And for the leadership candidates themselves, right, who have just been out there campaigning as senior shadow ministers for this entire campaign and campaigning for their own seats, like, they'll want some time with their families, and they'll want some time to chill for a bit. And then, they'll also want to be leader, so then they'll be stepping up.
And, and that's a really good point. Like, I don't want politicians who can't engage with people. There are a whole bunch of politicians that get into politics, like literally get elected in through safe seats, where they really don't need to get out there and on the hustings and do the retail stuff, the turning up to frigging chook raffles or walking this, knocking on doors or even just going talking to small businesses or getting in front of a bunch of union members or whatever, like just that sort of back and forth shaking hands and treading holes in your shoes. And so a leadership ballot puts people in that situation. And I think that's a really, really good thing because it's a good test for them. It's a good eye test for the voters, for the members. But also I just think that in the end, the better candidate is actually going to rise to the top and get elected. And I think that's good for them. One of the things I was a little bit disappointed about when Albo got the leadership was I just kind of thought, I mean, I know Albo went through the original leadership contest with Bill, but I was hoping there was going to be a contest again. I thought it was going to be good for the party because we're all a bit shitty after, you know, not winning in 20 – and when did this happen? This happened in 2019, right? We're all a bit kind of pissed off that we'd like – I thought we were going to win this one and we didn't. And I just thought the party needed another conversation, needed another little bit of a – and I didn't mind who ran, you know, whether it be, you know, Tanya or Jim or whoever, but I just thought the party needed to have another bit of a –
I think that's true.
Airing of grievances to, you know, kind of like quote Seinfeld, you know, like it just.
I think that never happened. That's right. It didn't happen. And there's something cathartic about it. I mean, people, when we lose an election, they're upset. They're confused. They're angry. Their anger may be placed in the right area or misplaced. But the opportunity to have it out, to have a contest conducted respectfully within the Labor family, but with a bit of a broader franchise than just a few people in a caucus room, I think is a really healthy thing. And I think it allows for whoever emerges as the leader to have a real claim to legitimacy.
Correct.
As that leader. And I think that's really, really important because politics has changed and the way that people interact with politics is much more direct now. We don't like our politics mediated through various structures. And the Labor Party hasn't necessarily kept up with this, nor most parties, to be honest. People expect direct connections with political leaders because they get that. Digital tools have allowed that. So there's a different expectation now. And I think if the Labor Party shies away from that, we're actually not meeting the community where they're at and we're meeting our members where they're at. So if we want to grow as a party, if we want to be a strong movement, we actually have to signal to people that we understand that they want to have input into these things. Now, it doesn't mean you vote on every single policy or anything like that or strategic decision, but the choice of leader is a really important one. And it's really important for that leader, for them, even if it's not your preferred candidate that wins, but if they come out of that legitimate, then that is better for everybody.
Yeah. And I think there's a nice sequencing of the pathway to government is first you take care of your actual base, which is your membership, like the rank and file, right? Once you get their endorsement and then you get the endorsement of your voting base and then you move to the wider community, which is those, you know, undecideds or persuadables and get their endorsement at an actual poll. And I to skip over the first bit sometimes feels like that you're building a house on foundations that's missing a couple of stumps basically. Anyway. Okay, let's talk about any other reflections or thoughts on the Labor side of things before we move on to just the minor parties before we wrap up.
No, I think that sums it up for now.
Okay, great. The Liberal Party, upsides for their campaign, obviously the Fruckers won, but what other upsides are there?
I mean, you know, elections are a binary thing, right? You win or you lose, so they won, so fair play to them. They were able to be returned to government after proposing an extremely unpopular spend on a stadium. They were able to navigate to victory a situation where Tasmanians are extremely excited for a new AFL team, for an AFL team, and also quite vehemently opposed to the stadium, which is a precondition for that team. That is not an easy square to circle. And, you know, they lost a big chunk of their vote, so, like, they didn't totally square that circle, but they were returned. So, you know, if I were them, I'd be like, well, look, we dodged it. We crawled over the line. We kind of figured it out. So, you know, props to them for that.
To that point though, Jack, before if you are going to move off of the AFL, I just want to get your thoughts on that because you and I, maybe we did it offline, just texting throughout the week when the announcement came out on the Monday or the Tuesday, which is the day I think we recorded our last episode, we were a little bit nervous about, is this going to sort of give this wave of Tasmanian patriotism to the incumbent and just bring them over the line in a big, big way. How do you think how does that look in terms of the wash up?
Well, to be honest, when that happened, and I think they sold something like 150,000 memberships, $10 memberships, but still 150,000.
Huge.
In the first week, huge, right? And look, you know, some people bought for their kids and blah, blah, blah. But, like, you know, it's still massive, right? It's a massive upswell in support. So when I saw that, and a lot of people saw that, we thought, oh, dear, like, this is, like, there's something here that the polls have missed, or people are willing, you know, they oppose the stadium, but it's just not going to matter, you know, because they want the team so badly, so much support. The Liberals campaign manager, Brad Stansfield, went on the Frontcast this week, which is a Tasmanian politics podcast, and he claims, you know, who knows, this is the first draft of history, but his claim as the campaign manager of the Liberals campaign was that the team launch really hurt the Liberals, that any time in the campaign that people were focused on the stadium was bad for the Liberals. And no one was focused on the stadium until the team launch. So while the team launch was super positive and it was an amazing time, instead of triggering, oh shit, we gotta re-elect the Liberals so we can get this team, it actually triggered, you know what, I'm really annoyed about this stadium that's attached to this team.
Yeah.
So his claim is that the Liberals' vote declined in the last week of the campaign, and they were in a stronger position a week earlier. So, you know, who knows? But that's certainly a claim.
It's funny, isn't it? It's almost counterintuitive. I watched the TV packages that night, and this was, this was on Channel 9 and 10 in Melbourne, but I'm assuming they're just grabbing the Hobart package anyway and just running it. But they framed it as AFL and Liberal government on one side in agreement supporting the Tasmanian team, Labor on the other side saying, well, you know, we think this is a great idea, but we're not too sure about the stadium. And it kind of gave this view that these were two opposing positions. It was AFL versus the Labor Party, the Labor opposition. And I was sort of looked at that and I went, oh, that's a bit of a worry, because everyone was so goddamn enthusiastic about this whole, to your point, like 110,000 people became members, for God's sake.
Yeah. And I think potentially something that the Labor Party may have done to improve their vote was to oppose the stadium more outwardly and more vigorously. So if you look back at polls, you know, a year ago, Labor was extremely opposed to the stadium. We were printing no stadium stickers and handing them out all over town. You know, it was an anti-stadium position that we took. Right. That position kind of moderated over time. Labor voted for the stadium to proceed through Parliament through a planning process. And the Liberals' campaign manager's take on this is that if Labor had stuck to a firm anti-stadium position, they would have improved their vote relative to the Liberals. The Lambie Network took a strong Jackie Lambie herself, I should say, took a strong anti-stadium position and was rewarded. So I don't know if that's true. Who knows? Mm. And you can't rerun the campaign. But Labor was certainly not providing a clear home by election day for people who were anti-stadium.
Downsides or challenges for the Liberal Party, maybe they're less about the campaign but more going forward, because you've sort of hinted about there is sort of internal party challenges or fissions going on.
I think there's two things, and they're always related, right? So there is how stable is this government? You know, Rockliffe went to this election promising strong, stable government to get away from the minority of the previous parliament. Well, he's ended up with a minority again. I would say his internal position is probably quite diminished. The big swing against the Liberals, the fact that they're back in minority, and the fact that, you know, Michael Ferguson on the right of the party and now Eric Abetz on the right of the party are, you know, in parliament, and I would not be surprised if there was potential challenges to his leadership, although how that would affect any confidence and supply deal with Jackie Lambie would be very interesting. So if I was Jeremy Rockliffe, I'd be making that deal pretty dependent on my own position as Premier, the deal directly with me, so to speak. So I think that's a real challenge they have going forward. Are they going to be able to put anything through this parliament? Are they going to be able to get any legislation through, or are they going to be negotiating everything with Labor, you know, or with the Greens or whatever? You know, and then there is, you know, how long do these Jackie Lambie elected folks kind of stay and work as a block? You know, no one's saying they'll quit parliament or anything, but, you know, are they all going to work together as the three of them? Who knows? Yeah. So I'd say it's a pretty rocky parliamentary road ahead, and I don't think that Jeremy Rockliffe has a huge degree of room to move given some of the pressures in his own party room.
They're meant to be four-year terms, aren't they, in Tasmania?
They're meant to be four-year terms, but the last two have been 3 years. We haven't had a four-year term for quite a while.
Yeah, right. So you sort of think that if you're Labor, in terms of a sort of a four-year strategy, you sort of first spend the first 12 months, so the next year, basically telling everyone that the voters are right and we were wrong, and also getting your ducks in a row, sorting out your leadership, getting everyone, just sort of setting up your processes to make another run at it. The second year, just let hopefully the Lambie network and the Libs just rip each other apart and just expose that for what it is. The third year, start to actually really ram it home and say, these are the things that are wrong with our state. And the fourth year, coming back in with all these are things that we're going to do to change Tasmania?
Absolutely. Assuming that it goes that long, right? Assuming that they have that level of stability. I mean, things move so quickly down here. I've been surprised at how quickly things can fall apart in Parliament. And Labor's very good in Parliament. Where we sometimes, I think, lack in the public, you know, kind of campaigning role, we do very well in Parliament.
Trouble is no one sees it.
No, but it does apply. You're right. It doesn't win any votes, but it does apply pressure to the other side. And I think we'll tell in the first couple of sitting weeks of Parliament if the government's losing any votes, or we're picking up sense from the crossbench or the folks who have given supply that's wobbly. We might not be talking about 4 years.
Interesting. Let's go to the Greens. Upsides for them from this campaign.
Well, they have efficiently distributed their vote, which has only gone up by 1%, sitting at around 15%. To pick up an additional, to more than double their parliamentary representation. So they've gone from 2 in the lower house to 3. There is a upper house election in the upper house seat of Hobart in a couple of months, and their former leader, Cassie O'Connor, is running for that. It's likely they'll pick up that seat as well. The Greens are kind of on the march in terms of seats. Now, they didn't have some massive swing towards them, but they... In some ways, they really understand the Hare Clark system. They run lead candidates in each seat, so it's very clear to people who want to vote Green who they should vote for first, rather than having leakage out of their ticket to other parties. They just concentrate their number one vote where they want it, and the folks who are filling the ticket are quite aware that they're filling the ticket. So it's an efficient way to run. They ran a fairly low-key campaign, I think, but they didn't make any mistakes. Rosalie Woodruff, their leader, is a strong communicator, but also, not an absolute rock star campaigner, but also doesn't make mistakes and is very good at building relationships. So I think they have really effectively used this election to kind of leverage themselves up into be a significant player in Parliament.
You may have named one key learning that maybe Labor can take from the Greens campaign, which is obviously that lead ticket or lead candidate on the ticket. Any other key lessons that we can take from looking at how the Greens campaigned?
I think they did a great job at recruiting their candidates, particularly their lead candidates. I guess it speaks to the strength and effectiveness of their strategy. They actually don't know who any of their other candidates are other than their lead candidates, because they're the only ones that they were promoting.
Yeah.
Tabitha Badger was elected, looks likely to be elected in Lyons, who's an environmental campaigner, but also, done some really interesting kind of stuff in small business and, young, really good communicator. You've also got Vicar Bailey in Clark, who's a long-time Wilderness Society campaigner. Like, folks that have had careers and built connections with deep connections with their community before going into Parliament, they're quite good, the Greens, at picking those folks and at bringing them on in a lead position. So I think their candidate selection is very good. They don't tend to have, people with extreme views on their ticket. I think they like to confound that expectation. If you meet any of these people, they are not what Labor folks might assume is a stereotypical Green. They're eminently reasonable, personable, progressive people. And I think they do very well at picking those.
Yeah, okay. Jackie Lambie Network, upsides for them. Obviously, a lot of upsides for them because they've done a lot well.
They just won 3 seats from nothing. So on a 6.5% vote. So without having to take any policy positions. It's easy being an anti-system party the first time. So that's the upside. I'll go straight to the downside. It's like, what do they do now? Mm. Now they're backing in this Liberal government. Jackie says she's against the stadium. I would assume the stadium will be in the budget papers. They're voting for confidence and supply. So are they voting for the stadium? It'll be a very different election. It'll be a very different campaign against Lambie next time, now that they have, runs on the board and a record in Parliament. So I think that is their downside coming out of this campaign. And their challenge is keeping their caucus together, having some sort of united position they can explain to the electorate, and essentially stopping those 3 folks splintering into independents.
And lastly, the independents, the 2 that are in the chamber, what do we expect from them? I'm just interested to get a sense of how they conduct themselves over the course of this term.
Yeah, I think from, we saw Christie elected as a full-term independent last time. you know, she's from the northern suburbs of Hobart, former mayor of Glenorchy. She'll keep advocating on transit in Hobart, which is shocking. Strong advocate for light rail and transport in Hobart, so I imagine she'll keep doing that. A range of integrity measures, a range of kind of accountability coming out of the commissioning of inquiry in Tasmania. She'll keep advocating for that, I'm sure. You know, I would expect her to carry on as she has, given that it's resulted in re-election. For David O'Byrne in Franklin, also elected as an independent, but obviously a solid Labor and union background, I would expect him to advocate for similar things to that the Labor Party would. David is pro-stadium, so, avidly pro-stadium, so I would expect that he would continue that advocacy, and I expect he'd continue to talk about public services, public sector wages, transport.
Interesting. Well, as always, Jack, in the words of Ron Burgundy, it's been rich and compelling. Unfortunately, we didn't get the result that we wanted, but we certainly thank you for your time that you've given to the show over the last couple of weeks. We've got a lot of great positive feedback from all of our listeners about these episodes, and so I'm really grateful for your time and your enthusiasm that you brought to the show.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been fun, and I'm glad you've had positive feedback, but folks can have a little break from Tasmania now, so, you know.
We'll see you in 6 months when you have to have another election.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say that, but yeah. Thanks, Stephen.
Very good.
Hey there. Thanks for listening to Socially Democratic. Did you like the podcast? Hit the follow or subscribe button and be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. And to get all the latest updates on Socially Democratic, follow Dunstreet on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And we'll see you next Friday.